You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, with Iran's presidential elections scheduled for June the 14th and Ahmadinejad unable to run for a third term, we sit down with one of the candidates, Hushang Amirahmadi.
The time has come for the Islamic Republic to allow people like me, who have solutions for all these problems, to get in and serve the country.
Ecuadorians are heading to the polls a little sooner, on Sunday in fact, for parliamentary and presidential elections. We'll discuss the pros and cons of Rafael Correa's near-certain re-election. We'll also drop in on our friends at Kintsune's latest venture, a shop and cafe in Tokyo's Omotesando.
When I saw the spaces, it was perfect for me to create kind of story. People can tell, I saw these Japanese like traditional entrance, and you get in and then there's a counter for coffee and then you get actually the store, a clothing store.
There's time too to hear from our executive producer Gillian Debias at the Berlin Film Festival, and we'll chew over the biggest news stories of the week with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield and our senior editor Sophie Grove. All that to come, plus we'll play some great music too, all in the next hour here on Midori House. Heaps to get through over the next hour, but before all that, let's get the latest world headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. More than 500 people have been injured after a meteorite shower in the Urals region of Russia, around 1,000 miles east of Moscow. The country's emergencies ministry says 82 of the injured are children, and two of them are in intensive care. A meteorite weighing around 10 tons is believed to have come down in a lake in the Chelyabinsk area. President Vladimir Putin said he thanked God no big fragments had fallen in populated areas. Members of Syria's opposition coalition say they're ready to negotiate President Bashar al-Assad's exit with any member of his government who has not participated in his military crackdown on the uprising. The political gap between the sides, along with a lack of opposition influence over rebel fighters on the ground and an international diplomatic deadlock preventing effective intervention, has allowed fighting to rage on, with UN estimates suggesting up to 70,000 people have been killed in the 22 months of conflict. A slaughterhouse owner in the north of England has been arrested by police investigating how beef products contained horse meat. Peter Boddy, who owns a slaughterhouse in Todmorden in Yorkshire, is accused of fraudulently selling horse flesh for use in kebabs and burgers in the UK. Another two men, David Raw Dees and another man from Farmbox's meats processing factory in Aberystwyth in Wales, have also been arrested. Britain's food regulator said today it had found 29 positive tests for horse meat after demanding samples from UK retailers engulfed in a contamination scandal that's spreading across Europe. Environment Minister Owen Paterson urged food businesses to get any required testing completed as soon as possible.
It is wholly unacceptable that any consumer should be presented with a product labelled as beef which contains horse. So consumers will be interested that the first meaningful results have come through, which show that the vast majority of products are clear of horse DNA. What it shows also, it's absolutely vital that we complete this intensive programme of testing, and it's up to food businesses to push on, get this testing completed, get the results out to the public to reassure the consumer.
The family of the murdered model Reva Steenkamp have said they are struggling to come to terms with her death, a day after her body was found at the residence of athlete Oscar Pistorius. Neighbours visited the house to offer their condolences, and flowers were being delivered to the family home in Port Elizabeth. Reva's uncle Mike Steenkamp told journalists the family were not following television coverage of the tragedy.
We haven't been watching TV and we haven't been listening to the radio. So it's been quite completely different inside the household and the family. The answer will come out. And I must just say one thing, you know, if you really believe in the Lord, that will come out. And we don't have to make any judgment. That judgment will be done then.
North Korea has told its key ally China that it is prepared to stage one or even two more nuclear tests this year in an effort to force the United States into diplomatic talks with Pyongyang, according to a source with direct knowledge of the message. Further tests could also be accompanied this year by another rocket launch, according to the source, who has direct access to the top levels of government in both Beijing and Pyongyang. And those are the top stories at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back to Midori House Live from Studio One in London. Iran goes to the polls this summer, 4 years after the country's so-called Green Revolution ended in defeat. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is stepping down after serving for 2 terms, but hopes that his successor may change the country's direction in any way are slim. Thanks to strong international sanctions, the economy is in free fall, and while the country's nuclear program continues to alarm its neighbours and the US. Elections in Iran are far from straightforward. Candidates have to be approved by the Guardian Council, and as you can imagine, anyone they think might cause problems is barred from standing. Hushang Amir Ahmadi hopes he will make the cut. A professor at Rutgers University in the US, Amir Ahmadi has begun a quixotic election campaign that has, so far, focused more on those outside Iran than inside. He came to Midori House earlier today to speak to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Hushang Amir Ahmadi, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House today.
And thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a slightly unusual election campaign. Your campaign's become president of Iran. We're sat here in London and your campaign is based in the US. How is that working?
Well, my campaign is not based in the US. My campaign is based on everywhere in the world, to be honest. It's a global campaign, and we are obviously focused on Iran, and the campaign is going on in Iran. We have a lot of people working as volunteer and others. But I have been living in outside the country for 40 years, and it's very natural that I will also be very active outside the country. And beyond that, I have spent 27 years of my life in international conflict resolutions, particularly U.S.-Iran relations. So, and I've been in this country for a while. I have been at Oxford University. So I'm a global person. I've been in Brazil. I've been all over the world. So again, I just like the way I am and who I have been, my campaign has become like that. You know, just I've been a global person. So I'm doing a global campaign.
You're doing a global campaign, but we're talking about an election which is unlikely to be either free or fair, certainly if what happened last time has any basis. Does that worry you?
Obviously it does. I'm trying my best to convince the Islamic Republic that the time has come for a fair election. I think the Islamic Republic faces tremendous problems, domestic, political, factional, infighting, conflict with the U.S. and the West, generally speaking, as well as economic malaise. I think the time has come for the Islamic Republic to allow people like me who have solutions for all these problems to get in and serve the country. The bad news for the Islamic Republic is that it just doesn't have the kind of person that is needed to solve these issues, that tackle these problems. You know, there is absolutely not a single person within the Islamic Republic that everybody will agree on in terms of coming together. The conflict with the U.S. seems to be in a deadlock, and the economy is being mismanaged every day and more so. So this is the situation. My hope is that given this situation, a person like me who has been for years a bridge builder, who has been for years a peacemaker, and whose expertise is economic development, will jump in and say, okay, I have nothing against the regime or the Nizam or the system, but I wanted to change the country. I wanted to be the Deng Xiaoping of Iran. That is not to change the regime, but the country.
Now, that may all sound well and good, but I mean, we're talking about a regime that I mean, for a start, has prevented you from running before in 2005. In 2007, the main opposition, 2009 rather, the main opposition leader, Mir Hussein Mousavi, end up under house arrest and is still under house arrest. This is not a democracy, in a sense. I mean, this is all well and good. We're having a nice chat, but this is pretty pointless, isn't it? It's going to go nowhere.
Yeah, but what options are there? Let me put it this way, all right? Moving forward ahead of us in Iran, there are three options. One option is just to stay with this the system as is. That's the modeling through. And the unfortunate fact is that every day, okay, this boss called the Islamic Republic, okay, which is on basically autopilot or cruise control, is going toward a cliff, okay? It's going to have to go. Unless someone jumps in, takes the steering wheel, puts the brake, and moves the car to a different direction. That's one option. Mm. The other option is a revolution, just like we did back in 1979. And that would be chaos. Unfortunately, the country doesn't have a single figure that will bring people together in such a situation. And that means a breakdown and a disintegration of the country. And finally, allow Iraq, you know, bring the U.S. and others or Libya to fight the Islamic Republic. And I think that's also, or just continuation of the sanctions. So these are the alternatives. Mm. None of them are really good for Iranian people. They are not good for the regime. They are not good for anybody. I don't think it's good for the region, for the West, because Iran is a trendsetter. As a trendsetter country, whatever happens there, it will immediately spread. Iranian revolution is spread. Iranian constitutional revolution spread, Iranian oil nationalization spread, the day spreads, okay? So anything that happens in Iran, and if it's done the wrong way, it will spread in the region. My alternative is the best, only best alternative. Again, I am not an idealist, I'm a realist, I'm a pragmatist. I think there are lots of problems, obstacles with this alternative, but that's the only really good alternative available to the Iranian people. Is non-violent, is within the laws of the Islamic Republic.
Indeed.
I don't know what the Islamic Republic wants.
That was Hushang Amirahmadi speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, there. And you can hear the second part of Steve's interview where they discuss Iran's relationship with the United States in the Monocle Daily later tonight. That kicks off at 2200 hours UK time. Coming up, more elections, but we're moving from Iran to Ecuador after this.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
You're listening to Midori House. The time in London is 18:15. Ecuador is getting ready for the presidential and parliamentary elections that take place this Sunday. The current president, Rafael Correa, faces a divided and weakened opposition and is expected to win. Correa has been accused of running a campaign against the Ecuadorian media. The last years have seen lawsuits against journalists and private media companies. But at the same time, his charismatic persona still strikes a chord among most Ecuadorians. To tell us about the themes of these elections and the significant opposition candidates, we're joined in the studio by Tiago Aragao, Senior Research Associate at the Foreign Policy Centre, based in Brasilia, New York and London. Tiago, thank you very much for coming in. It seems like it will be a shoe-in for Correa. Do you agree?
Yes, I agree. These elections, they bring nothing new regarding what the opposition could present to beat Correa. It's definitely the easiest of the three elections that he participated so far. And it's set for a secure win.
Why has he maintained such a strong hold over his post? Is it just that the opposition is so fragmented that there hasn't been a stronger candidate? Or does he really capture the heart of the nation still?
Well, it's a combination of factors. To a grand part of the population, he delivered decent results. He was able to deliver a certain growth in social development. He was able to enable a certain economic growth. And what is very typical for South American countries, public expenditure is seen with good eyes, not with bad eyes. So he increased from 2006 until now 250% of public expenditure. So this shows the population that he's doing something. You add to this charisma, the power of the microphone, which he's able to deliver decent messages, and at the same time, a struggle for power within the opposition and a lack of common message. The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the general population, is the 60% of the population who's voting for Correa right now.
Goodness. So, I mean, it really does seem incredibly, well, not likely is the wrong word to use, but definite that he will get voted in again. Do you think he will just continue along the same path of having quite a nationalistic stance in his next term?
Yes. I tend to say that as often, when you start repeating and doing things more often, you start to lose fear. And he definitely lost fear in regards to how to treat the media, how to treat the opposition, and also lost fear in how to bring results that he believes that will maintain the population on his side. On the negative aspects, we have seen, besides the media aspect that we just spoke, he seized a lot of the power in the legislative parliament in Ecuador. And this is not good. We can expect further public expenditure. We can expect further seizure of rights of the media, difficulties for the legislative power to show itself off. And we can see that Correa, he is one of the few survivors with a certain success, to say, of that group of leftist leaders that came along with Hugo Chavez and Evo from Venezuela and Evo Morales from Bolivia. So I believe that Correa, he can be more blunt. During his third term, he will face more difficulties, and more difficulties definitely bring more radicalism.
And so if we're sort of jumping ahead to the future to look at the next election, do you feel that actually the opposition will have seen their stumbling points from this election, that really there hasn't been a coordinated, concerted oppositional movement that has inspired anything in the country to vote for anybody except Correa? And do you think that are lessons that they will learn in order to kind of become a little bit more united and really provide a challenge to Correa the next election from now?
The opposition don't need to look far to see what they need to do to get close or bring real chances of beating the presidential candidate. In Venezuela, in the first elections against Hugo Chavez, we had exactly the same problem. We had a fragmented opposition that killed the possibility of getting votes from each other. And Ecuador is undergoing this phase right now. I think the key aspect is to identify a message, identify an individual that has a certain link with the population, which he can be associated, and he has to have two types of message, one that delivers immediate results and one that delivers midterm results. When you add all this with charisma, you have enough ingredients to be someone that can face a type like Rafael Correa.
And are we seeing anyone in the opposition that might feasibly, 3-4 years from now, have that quality?
I don't think so. I think definitely can be built someone like that. Oppression usually generates great leaders. Throughout history, we have seen fantastic leaders that came through oppression. And I would not doubt that in the future, we could see a fantastic leader coming out in Ecuador, maybe from the press. Someone that could represent a voice that is being not able to work properly. But it's a very important point to bring that Rafael Correa is not only a leader that suppresses the press or the legislative. He's delivering results. And this combination proves extremely hard for the opposition. So someone needs more than charisma. They need the smooth talk and the practical talk.
And Correa needs to put a foot wrong as well, presumably.
Exactly.
Something for the opposition to focus on.
Yes, putting a foot wrong, it's always important, because if he does a flawless third term, it's much harder to see something. But there are flaws in there. He depends a lot on oil revenues. And right now, he did all the investments he needed to do in Petroecuador, their country's oil company. And he already got all the royalties that he could get from the private companies. He seized those royalties. So for him to get more revenues from oil, he either needs to find more oil fields in Ecuador, or the oil scenario in the world needs to change drastically so the prices go way up. So, of course, there will be revenue problems in the future that tend to bring problems that could lead him to shoot himself in the foot.
And finally, what will the mood be like on Sunday or Monday when the result is announced? Will it be a bit sort of like, oh, well, we all knew, sort of not a sigh of relief, presumably, but a bit of, well, more of the same?
Yes, compared with previous Ecuadorian elections, I think it will be a sort of boring mood in which people will be probably more focused on their football league games that could be happening that day and won't. And imagining and how the next government will be.
Well, Tiago Aragao, Senior Research Associate at the Foreign Policy Center, thank you very much for coming into Midori House.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from London, where the time is 18:23. We're off to Japan now. Kitsune got its start as a record label in 2002, but co-founders Gilda Loek and Masaya Kuroki have since opened fashion boutiques in Paris and New York. Their newest venture, a shop and a cafe in Omotesando, Tokyo's fashion centre. The two properties sit a block away from each other, but aesthetically they couldn't be more different. Maison Kitsune Tokyo is airy, bright and filled with the duo's apparel for men and women. Cafe Kitsune is low-ceilinged, dimly lit and cosy, with wood panelling and a Parisian-style stand-up espresso bar that was built by artisans who normally work on Japanese soba noodle shops. Monocle's Kenji Hall visited the cafe on opening day for a chat with Masaya Kuroki.
This is Masaya Kuroki from Maison Kitsune. We are right now in Minami Aoyama district, just a little bit upper than Omotesando, Tokyo. Here we are in Cafe Kitsune. We opened just today, just a few hours ago, basically. Very first Kitsune cafe.
Describe the shop a little bit, because it's very
Japanese looking in that it's quite modern.
Yes, that's actually maybe my vision of the Japan, how I see with this. I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan. The papers are really traditional Japanese paper, and ajiro behind the counter, it's like you see it usually in a soba place or unagi place, or even a little garden inside. It's like a Japanese landscaper make coming from Kyoto, walk with me. All the wood, I mean, everything is just like Japanese wood, and then a lot of special taint. So there's almost like seven variation of the tainting of the wood. So that's make feel quite warm and scale. It's so low ceiling. I wanted to create really the traditional Japanese, you know, scale. Bonsai, it's beautiful. That's why we have in the middle of the store, the bonsai and all the antique Japanese antique. I really want to tell them, you know, how beautiful it is, all the Japanese traditional, actually.
Talk about the workmanship that went into this cafe. The wood is really, really beautiful. I understand you hired traditional craftsmen, traditional artisans to work on the shop here.
It's not like Japanese really traditional hinoki or something like that, but some of the wood are just simple Japanese paint or very simple. It's just the way how it's painted, it's made all the difference. Craft guys, I made them coming from the south actually, from around Osaka basically. They came specially to work with me to just paint it. So every day we try different paint and darker, let's go lighter, darker, and it's amazing how it's real painters, these guys, they're real artists actually. And then usually they make the facade of the soba place or sushi place or so that was really a pleasure. And then even for the small garden, we are having an entrance which is like very, very small, but in the small scale how Japanese landscaper can make the amazing choice of the stones, choice of the plant we put, you know, to create this small rhythm of, it's almost like it looks like go to the ryokan entrance, you know.
No tables.
Exactly. Well, maybe, you know, they will understand slowly, but I would like to launch this, counter culture, which is my culture, which is in Paris actually. But actually it's very Japanese too, because they're having soba on the counter, they're having sushi on the counter, so why not having espresso in the morning on the counter and then just go to the work, or you know, in the afternoon they stop by 5 minutes, have their 5 minute break. And I think the size I made it is really Japanese, so, and then we can sit down in a little garden and it's a takeaway as well. So in the morning we had a lot of people actually walking around the neighborhood, just stop by and, oh, what it is? Oh, it's a new cafe now. Oh, but you guys selling t-shirts, or what it is, you know? But a lot of, you know, curious people, Japanese are curious, so I'm happy about that. There's no facade, and well, it's not like my goal to be hidden, but it's more to create a curiosity to attract people, like, because I think today, of course, there's different way to do the retail, but when I saw the spaces, it was perfect for me to create kind of, you know, story. People can tell, yeah, I saw this Japanese, like, traditional entrance, and you get in, and then there's a counter for coffee, and then you get actually the store, a clothing store, and then it's a music label doing this. You know, so it's create, you know, I like to create certain surprising people. I think it's important, you know, because I'm under the Maison Kitsune, the main store, the bigger one, it's more like really fashion retail, you know. Most really I'm happy, it's our coffee. I'm very proud of our coffee, our blend. And I see so many people since this morning, kids, and they really enjoy it. I see it, they taste it. It's very strong espresso, so it's not in really in the culture yet. Even Japanese, they love coffee. But our style is really like Italian, like really like short espresso. My coffee. Coffee, I'm really happy because I'm really addicted of the coffee. So yeah, myself, I had already a few, you know, and I'm very happy.
And that was Kenji Hall at Cafe Kitsune in Tokyo. You're listening to Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monaco 24.
Wei yu dun dun. Zhe shi Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll go through this week's biggest news with Steve Bloomfield and Sophie Grove. We'll check in with our executive producer, Gillian Tobias, who's in Berlin for the Berlinale Film Festival. And in our regular Friday segment, we'll be knocking on the doors of one of Monocle's neighbours too. But before all that, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
More than 500 people have been injured after a meteorite shower in the Urals region of Russia, around 1,000 miles east of Moscow. The country's emergencies ministry says 82 of the injured are children and two of them are in intensive care. Members of Syria's opposition coalition say they are ready to negotiate President Bashar al-Assad's exit with any member of his government who has not participated in his military crackdown on the uprising. The political gap between the sides, along with a lack of opposition influence over rebel fighters on the ground and an international diplomatic deadlock preventing effective intervention, has allowed fighting to rage on, with UN estimates suggesting up to 70,000 people have been killed. A slaughterhouse owner in the north of England has been arrested by police investigating how beef products contained horse meat. Peter Boddy, who owns a slaughterhouse in Todmorden in Yorkshire, is accused of fraudulently selling horse flesh for use in kebabs and burgers in the UK. G20 officials are to disregard key parts of a currency statement issued this week by the Group of Seven Powers, according to a communique drafted for finance leaders meeting in Moscow. A G20 delegate who has seen the draft put together by deputy finance ministers for their bosses said it would not single out Japan, nor would it make direct mention of new debt-cutting targets. The family of the murdered model Reva Steenkamp have said they are struggling to come to terms with her death, a day after her body was found at the residence of athlete Oscar Pistorius. Neighbours visited the house to offer their condolences and flowers were being delivered to the family home in Port Elizabeth. Kenya's High Court has cleared the way for Uhuru Kenyatta to run in next month's presidential election, dismissing arguments that his looming trial on charges of crimes against humanity made him ineligible. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, dit is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time in London is 18:32, and with the week almost at an end, it's time to take stock and reflect back on the stories we've been keeping an eye on over the past few days. I'm happy to say that I'm joined now by Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello.
Hello, and senior editor, Sophie Grove.
Hello.
Hi, Sophie. I'm going to come to you first, Sophie. Tell us what's been tickling your news fancy this week.
Well, we were all really sort of gripped by the news that the Pope was going to retire. It's the biggest news of the week.
Gripped,
in
we
fact,
were. Gripped.
We were. I mean, we it were. Was such a surprise. The first, I mean, he...
800 years.
It really is a big decision. And it seems like he just came up with it completely alone.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we were churning that news over. At one point, I think I went to sleep listening to, you know, his motives and, you know, who might succeed him. And then woke up to it. It was very much the rolling news story of the week.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting because, you know, looking back over some of the commentary we've seen is, you know, what does this mean for the Catholic Church? You know, will they sort of bring in somebody who might reform the church and a progressive?
Mm.
And it looks like they probably won't. But it's so interesting that also that debate was thrown up, and everyone usually just waits for popes to kind of slowly...
it's interesting, though, isn't it, that instead of dying when people can sort of take stock and also with sort of sensitivity reflect on the positives of someone's career, when someone resigns, it's an opportunity to actually be a little bit harsher and think, well, is it time for change?
Exactly.
And
is it time to bring someone in from the developing world or,
exactly,
or Latin America, where there are sort of actually billions of Catholics? And it's interesting, you know, I'm a Catholic. You're a Catholic.
I'm a Catholic.
And we're progressive
we're not going
Catholics.
To talk about me.
But it's very interesting just to, you know, to think, oh, this could be an opportunity for, you know, the faith you've been brought
change.
Up in to completely change, mm. and then to feel so disappointed that it probably won't. But it's just so wonderful to see that there are people who come out there and sort of give another option, and you know, there are progressive voices that are trying to sort of make change happen in Catholic Church.
Thank you, Sophie. Steve.
as a Jew, I try not to talk about Catholic issues. It just you know, becomes problematic, particularly as a Jewish atheist. So the things that I was interested by, intrigued. Mm. Obviously, there was a State of the Union from Barack Obama, which feels like quite a long time.
It does feel like a long time. It's been a big week for news, actually, hasn't it?
It really has.
And also surprising news.
Yes, indeed. And so that was obviously, I mean, it was, you know, it's a big set piece event. It was, you know, fascinating to see how the Republicans were going to deal with what he said. And I think what was interesting about it was that there was so much talked about the things around it rather than the substance of the speech itself. You know, Marco Rubio's gulp of water, who the different congressmen invited, rather than the substance, which was actually quite interesting because, you know, he was really sort of laying out the groundwork for, you know, trying to be a little bit conciliatory, a little bit, you know, I can be the man of compromise, but also, you know what, guys, I was elected, this is what I want to do. And I think, you know, that new attitude will be really interesting to see, you know, how that develops over the coming months.
Definitely. I mean, two big stories that have come out in the last 2 days are Oscar Pistorius' tragic. Well, we don't really know the full details of it yet.
I mean, it's a difficult story for anyone to cover, really. And I think it's, you know, we've decided, yeah, in a sense, really. I mean, we've done it in the news, news headlines, because it is news. But aside from what you can really say about it, there's really not much that you can. And that's why actually we've chosen not to cover it properly in any of our shows, just because. You know, I mean, we've been watching all the rolling news networks do it, and all they're doing is saying, well, he's in court, and this is what he said, and this is what some people said, and there was a lot of speculation in those first few hours, which turned out to be complete nonsense. Yeah. And the fact is, no one knows, and now there's a trial going on, and we'll see what happens, but, you know, for all concerned, it's a tragedy. The other thing we've all been looking at, of course, is the horse meat saga, which has sort of rumbled on here in the UK and throughout the rest of Europe.
And I think here at Monaco, we always talk about outsourcing and the perils of you know, losing track of your chain, even if it is a food chain. And this scandal in the UK really shows that is the case.
Absolutely. And today, meteor shower in Russia as well.
Yeah, the meteor was kind of stunning. And David Whitehouse on the briefing, it's worth going back on the time shift and listening to him, because basically he was saying, yeah, we can't predict these and it will happen again somewhere. Good luck.
And the footage was extraordinary.
It really was.
It reminds of so many films that you've seen. We're going to go into a track now, which is the theme tune from one such film. I'll leave you to put two and two together. This is Aerosmith with Don't Wanna Miss a Thing. Wonderful soppy sing-along here in Studio One. That was Aerosmith with Don't Wanna Miss a Thing. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Next up, we'll be checking in with our executive producer, Gillian Tobias, who's in Berlin for the Berlinale Film Festival.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we host country rock legend Steve Earle. Head to Berlin and Burma for art and books, and via Mark Wallinger's new works for the London Underground, check out the new music scene in Egypt.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:42 in London. And Monocle's executive producer, Gillian Tobias, is in Berlin now, racing around the city at the Berlin Film Festival, otherwise known as the Berlinale. She's a film festival veteran of sorts, and I dragged her away from her schnitzel earlier to ask what sets Berlin apart.
Beside that it's colder than any film festival I've been to. What I love about it is so many festivals, it's for the industry, and it's kind of a bit of a club. Hollywood moguls and producers, they get together and they show films and they see films and they talk about films. But this festival is the world's largest public festival. So they sell over 300,000 tickets to members of the public. And of course, the industry is swirling around as well, and filmmakers. But it really is what film should be about, which is about the audience. And I think that's fantastic, and you really sense that when you walk around the streets at night and you turn a corner and suddenly there's another cinema. And it has lanterns and it has lights and posters lit up and people streaming to the cinema.
How wonderful. So the whole city has taken over, and yeah, like you say, it's not just a sort of elite queues for the industry bigwigs, but everybody can get involved.
And what's nice about it is because it is in Berlin, and so you have the West Berlin cinemas, you have the East Berlin cinemas, and this is a city that has such a heady cinema history and movie-making history, and it's really nice to see the different characters of the neighborhood and the different architecture of the cinemas, you know, that have seen quite a bit of history in their time.
Exactly. There's a big, big cinematic history in Berlin. And I gather that today you've been at Studio Babelsberg as well. I want to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. It really was. I mean, of course, I'm passionate about filmmaking. So for me to walk through the gates of the really legendary Studio Babelsberg was, I have to say, I had shivers down my back, because this is where, you know, cinema history was made. I mean, the films of the early 20s. I mean, this is a 100-year-old movie studio, which started in 2012. But some of the most iconic films, from Fritz Lang's Metropolis, Marlene Dietrich filmed there at the Blue Angel. And it's incredible to walk in their footsteps, but then see this really vibrant filmmaking studio now.
And that's what I was going to ask, is, I mean, obviously huge, huge history there, but it has a future too, does it?
Well, what's interesting is that they're very smart, but they realize that there's so many competitive film studios all vying to get the biggest budget productions onto their turf. So Babelsberg are very clever, and they become co-producers, in effect, and they work with various different federal and regional sort of grant systems to bring incentives for productions to come from abroad to film there. But most importantly, not just the incentives, but the German skill and craftsmanship and their efficiency is just such high quality that it's huge benefit for films who are always so worried, the film producers, of going over budget and shoddy workmanship. So, you
exactly.
know, that
and
is
it
the
is,
one
it's all German stuff. Workers and the production teams and things. It's not sort of outsourced, or they don't bring in cheap labor at all. It's very much rooted in German people.
Oh, totally. And they really believe, I mean, they have a slogan, which is, I think, act global, spend local. So they really have generations of crews and craftsmen. So the people who work in the props department, the people who work in the carpentry department, the plasterers, the makeup artists, the costume designers, their fathers before them, or mothers, were working on the films from decades past. So it almost is a trade that's handed down through the generations. And we were getting the tour, and at one point the person showing us around said, well, that's a father and a son, they're working together, because, you know, they learn the craft and the trade and they stay with the studios. It was fantastic.
How wonderful. And presumably this is what gives the studio its very sort of unique character still as well.
Well, it's mixed. I mean, it's definitely the efficiency and the German craftsmanship, but it's also that, and it, without doubt, like the big directors like Tarantino and Polanski, they are a bit in awe of the directors that were there before him. And we heard that, you know, Tarantino, when he walked for the first time on the Marlene Dietrich set, he just walked to the walls and put his hands on the walls and just said what it meant to him to be able now to be a director, having grown up with those films, and to be directing on the same stage. So it's quite, if you're into film, it's very heady.
Wonderful. Well, you were there on a pilgrimage of sorts, making a film yourself, which will be on monocle.com in a few weeks' time. And very much look forward to seeing it.
A few days' time. Well,
a few days' time.
We're doing a few films. So I'll have to work out, stagger my little film, my modest film productions. But yes, we filmed all around the festival, and we filmed at the studios, so that will be be on monocle.com to coincide with our German issue.
Oh, well, thank you very much indeed for joining us, Gillian Tobias, in Berlin at the Berlinale Film Festival there. And let's stay around in Berlin for a song. This is Paul Kalkbrenner with Sky and Sand. In the daytime, you will find me by your side, trying to do my best, trying to make things right. When it all turns wrong, there's no fault but mine, but it won't hit hard. Beautiful song from Berlin there. That was Sky and Sand by Paul Kalkbrenner. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back. The time here in London is 18:50, and it's Friday, which means that for a brief moment, one of the growing number of Monocle outposts around the globe takes to the streets to meet the people and businesses forming the backbone of the communities we work in. Today it's the turn of Hong Kong. We went down to meet Adrian Chu of the Chinese Timekeeper to find out what makes his store tick.
A lot of the history of China has a lot of relationship with timekeeping. In the customers today, in the luxury industry, a lot of them are Chinese, and there is a very strong Chinese influence in terms of design and manufacturing. So I thought it was time to create a product, a brand that was proudly Chinese, from design, from manufacturing, from the heritage and the story we're sharing. And that's the concept behind the Chinese Timekeeper, where we wanted to be a proud Chinese luxury watch company. The first idea was 4 years ago. And it took me 2 years from, oh, let's do a brand, to, you know, put the artwork, the design, find a story, work with the watchmakers and find the right workshop to have a good level of quality. And the brand was launched October 10, 2010, so 10-10-10. The brand and the concept is obviously my work, but I'm always working with local graphic designers, because there is a lot of culture involved in my brand. There is a lot of aspect in Chinese heritage, such as the jade or the 24-hour dial or the zodiac sign. We have a snake watch, a dragon watch. And for these elements, I obviously need the expertise of a local designer to tell me, you know, what a Chinese dragon looks like and what the jade, how to work with jade properly. And also we work very closely with the Hong Kong watchmakers, who tell us the difference between what's possible and what's not possible to do, what they're confident in terms of quality and design execution. So it's a three-party work in a way. I've been here 12 years and obviously I like Chinese culture, but I also like the Chinese mentality today, or everything is possible and you can always do something and achieve something, and there is a lot of hard work and motivation and ambition in this country. So I like the culture, but I like also modern day China, where it's very fast moving. And also I really believe there is a lake and there is a demand for this. There is nothing really proudly Chinese today in the market, and it's starting to move. You see more shoe designer and fashion designer and jewelry designer that are, you know, proudly Chinese, and they're moving with their own aesthetics and their own history. And I thought it was time to do something for the bit more complicated watch industry, where we could really establish a Chinese brand. The boutique in Hong Kong has two kind of different customers. A lot of our, I'll say 50% are foreigners living in Hong Kong. I am a foreigner, so it's easy for me to communicate through foreign people, but a lot are mainland Chinese and Hong Kong customers through different media and articles and websites and blogs. We can touch this population. All our customers buy for the same reason, because we're a Chinese brand and they're really looking for a different product, and they're happy to find us. We're already looking into major Asian cities such as Taipei, Singapore, Shanghai, Beijing, to duplicate our business model with different boutiques where we can really talk about our brand and showcase our uniqueness in these different boutiques. And that's something we're working very hard at. We're joining the Basel World exhibition in Switzerland, which is the biggest watch fair in the world, for the second time this year. We're going to launch new watches there, which are going to be truly unique. So we have two watches that are very unique in the Chinese Timekeeper collection. Is our jade automatic. We are the only brand in the world today to carry grade A Burmese jade in our dial, in our collection. And as you can see in this watch, every piece of jade has different color, different texture, a bit of a different size, so it makes it a very unique watch. It's very beautiful to look at, very pure and clean. The other watch that is also very unique, the Chinese Hours Automatic Collection. We have 12 signs of the zodiac. Each sign of the zodiac represents 2 hours, so it's a 24-hour dial. So again, this is the only watch in the world that properly represent the traditional Chinese hour. So it's you know, it's very exciting. It's the hour of the ox, and then the hours of the tiger, the rabbit. It's different way of thinking of the time. So it's not easy to look at your watch and know what time is it, but it's a real talking piece. So for collectors, for customer looking to for a very unique piece, this is it.
Adrian Chu of the Chinese Timekeeper in Hong Kong there. And now it's time for our daily monologue. Today we turn to our incoming Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, who after her recent trip around Asia and the Antipodes with the Monocle clan, has found she favours the value of face-to-face meetings.
Over the last week, I've been on a whirlwind tour of Asia Pacific with half a dozen or so of my Monocle colleagues. We've had drinks at an independent inn on Waiheke, an island sitting 30 minutes away by ferry from downtown Auckland, ogled picture-perfect views of the Sydney Opera House from a terrace of the recently refurbished Park Hyatt, and braved the humidity outside a bookstore in Singapore's cosy Tiong Bahru neighbourhood. Tomorrow, we'll be finishing up the trip at the Monocle shop in Hong Kong. This hasn't been an elaborate company retreat, nor an itinerary packed full for editorial purposes. Our tour has been built around meeting our friends and subscribers from these four important regions, hosting them for a drink or two, and simply having a chat. From a retired statistician from Australia's Ministry of Defence to a Kiwi with a DIY yoghurt company, and representatives from the Sarawak media industry, the readers we met at these further afield events were a diverse bunch. And when many of them asked what the purpose of our trip was, some were surprised to hear that they were, in fact, it. While hackneyed terms like global connectivity are thrown around boardrooms seeking to justify spending chunks of budgets on social media and the teams that manage it, we think that being connected globally means actually getting out there and meeting the people who matter to our business. No number of hashtags or pokes can make up for shaking a hand, exchanging a business card, and sharing a little bit of FaceTime. Not only are our subscribers invested in what we do, they're a constant source of information on their region. The tips they'll give us on local cafes and shops will often make their way onto the pages of the magazine. And from a self-taught small leather goods craftsman in Singapore to a gallerist bringing Aboriginal art out of Australia, our readers themselves could also inspire a story or two. Today, many businesses see social media as an essential part of their strategy. Investing time and money in employees who know how to retweet, reblog and regurgitate any notion of content that they can lay their hands on. I'll be leaving Hong Kong next week with a holder bursting full of business cards, and if an email or call pops up from one of my new Antipodean or Asian contacts, I'll be able to recall their face rather than an online profile. Being invited to an annual event hosted by the company I follow would far surpass the experience of digesting their hourly tweets. More businesses should move the money they spend on social media management to creating times and places to meet core clients and customers. It's not about how many followers you have, it's about who your followers actually are. For Monocle in Singapore, I'm Aisha Spears.
And that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Barbara Feeney. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Next up on the menu, we'll head to Cairo to find out why it's taken so long for Egyptian cuisine to be served up in restaurants.
I think there is a big renaissance in the food service sector in Egypt and introducing Egyptian and, you know, what they call the baladi chic and stuff like that.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.